the hierarchy of contribution and accomplishment was. And
had you changed any or developed any new role models by the time you were getting through high school?
Not in the sense of an Einstein. I'd seen these marvelous books that I just quoted to you, and I thought they had a lot to teach. I didn't identify with them. I was still the student looking at what teachers had to say. Mm-hmm. But the images of people like Pasteur and Koch and the others that de Kreif and so on talked about were there. I guess I hoped I might someday be a person like some of those without being too closely identified, but I'd have to work very hard and be very diligent and so on. There's a real paradox, you know. On the one hand, I had pretensions about being the smartest person I knew, and I was going to learn everything, and I did know more about most things than most of the people that I've met in terms of my book learning, certainly. At the same time, I underestimated myself. I mean, if I look fairly objectively about that, and I can't quite piece that out. I did have a unique mentality, but I didn't explore the full meaning of that term. And I guess I felt there must be somewhere hundreds of other kids like that, if I can only get to meet them, find, have someday the university or some group of that sort. I did not have a clearly formed picture of where I would stand in that hierarchy. And, you know, to have ended up having won a Nobel Prize by the time I was 33, and for work I'd done as 21, I had no dream of anything like that. And that might have been the end of a lifetime of very hard work and so forth. So it's, in that sense, not totally accurate. But there is that paradox. I'm still trying to resolve this in my own head about where I would have placed myself. I may have seen myself as being the biggest fish in a very small pond, but there must have been oceans around that I didn't know anything about that I have to think about. It's probably the closest metaphor I can think of.
Well, sometimes I've heard people say that.
I would have thought it would have been blasphemous for me to compare myself to Einstein, let's say. Maybe I still do. I mean, but that isn't what I meant when I said to be like him would be to be some pale image of that kind of personality would be a more accurate reflection of it.
Did you have you've had this interest in science from as far back as you can remember, virtually? Did you have any broad picture of science in terms of its usefulness, rather than its just being an intellectual exercise?
Oh, sure. They were all merged. The scientific method would be the salvation of our political and social problems. If you could only think that way, if you could be dispassionate, you could end up being more effective and more compassionate in the long run. One had to distance oneself from a problem in order to really effectively deal with it. So there again, there's that kind of ambivalence. I had no thought about science for weapons. A great deal of indoctrination about all the advances in medical science. So microbe hunters would have been the paradigm. And here, many wonderful things had, extraordinary things had come about, and yet they were all based on very, very basic research whose outcomes could be predicted. It was all seamless web, so I mean, the picture I have now, I'm sure, was pretty close to what I had then. I had a little more faith that scientific accomplishment would more or less automatically work out to human good, because I thought that its method, its focus on long-term goals and so on, would be part and parcel of how it would be used. And that was obviously somewhat naive. And, you know, to that degree, the bomb was certainly a turning point in what's thinking about that.
You were already at Columbia when Pearl Harbor occurred, is that right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So before we...
Well, we're still at that epoch. I want to just recall about the World's Fair and the Museum of Science and Industry. That was a great treat. I mean, this... I just take a film of reminiscence about that. It was on Channel 13 the other night, and those are very vivid images, the Trilon and Perisphere, its symbolism, and this was the new theology. I mean, that's the church steeple, but in the name of science. And, you know, an optimism about the technology, and then the paradox of all this happening just as the world's going to war. And, that wasn't lost. So, you know, the image was, here's this wonderful opportunity if people would only think scientifically, whereas I would have used it those days. But they don't, and you know, human folly is going to result in the misuse of all that technology to the only somehow inspire a more, I would have been, use the label, you know, more rational use of those kinds of resources. So, I mean, that was the basic paradox. I haven't totally resolved that yet. But then there was just all kinds of stuff. I remember they had the Camp Transparent Woman. They had all the organs laid out in rather wonderful way, and this is a piece of natural history, nowhere better. This exposed, there was Polaroid, and I'll keep going in line again and again to get the little free samples of these things and play with this stuff. There was Bakelite, and again, grab samples of it and cook it up at home.
It's a formaldehyde
resin, you know. there's some chemistry there that I'm still involved with in my current research.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
But, I mean, there again, these images of technological utopia. But I'd already also read Aldous Huxley and Brave New World and so on, and I understood quite early what the downside might be about the potentialities for self-destruction. And what was going on in Germany was perfectly evident. I mean, here's a people that sort of allowed themselves to be taken over and then become a menace to the rest of the world. I didn't feel I could understand those phenomena, and I still don't, at a social and political level. It's our biggest challenge to know how to keep ourselves from doing all those things. The Museum of Science and Industry was somewhat earlier. This is in
Chicago?
Radio City.
No, here.
Used to be one here. Not a bad match for one that still exists in Chicago.
Really? I didn't realize.
And it was the same sorts of things I've mentioned with the World's Fair. Half of it was sort of silly, but straight out of Detroit, and all the ways you can make gears turn. And you have very funny looking gears, you know, square ones and elliptical ones and so forth. Machines that were balls bouncing off of a steel plate but with perfect precision. And it did give one a sense of determinism, that even something that you think of flipping a coin as being a random event, but you realize that that's because you don't completely control all the impulses that put on a penny. They had some very early demonstrations of television, and I remember teleautography, distant writing as well on there, and I was imbued with what communications were going to generate for us as of that time. So those are the main messages there. But there again, there was a euphoria about how wonderful technology was. And I did a poster in junior high school, which is my own version of Better Things for Better Living Through Chemistry. I've just retrieved that from the DuPont archives and send it in as one of the things for the Oxford. Did I tell you about the Oxford Dictionary of Scientific Quotations?
Yes. Did you get my letter about
I just got it. It's in this morning's mail. That's all. So I dug that out as one of the, at least it was one of my icons. But it's just so emblematic of that sense of optimism. You know, they don't even dare use the word chemistry these days.
No.
What a difference.
Well, Dow Chemical is one of the few companies that's kept its, purposely kept the name chemical in its name, although they seriously considered removing it back about 20 years ago.
But this one they were making napalm?
Amongst the Agent Orange, they had mercury in Lake Huron, they had a number of problems they had to deal with. And, but they...
Anyhow, I just wanted to recreate that... That sense of optimism, that level of that era.
Where was this museum located?
Radio City.
On Radio City.
Yeah. They, quite recently, in the last 6-8 years, I remember talking to Bess Meyerson. She was then the deputy mayor for cultural affairs. There was some rumor about getting a thing like that started again, and I begged her to get it set up again in its old place, or the AT&T building, but she got into some political deal with Manus over in Queens and got stuck out in Flushing. It's all right, but I think it would have been better at a more central location.
How long did that exist? Did it have a long lifespan?
No, it was folded up probably in 42. Mm-hmm. So we not had a lot of things like that. Okay.
Is there anything else? That's the year, let's see, graduated from high school in, boy,
January 41.
January 41. All right. And you spent the spring semester at AISL. I'm wondering if you could talk some more about that. We sort of skipped over that lightly. And, for example, you mentioned here about the first time you saw IBM punch cards or something like that. I'm just wondering if you could tell me a little more about that whole laboratory situation.
Well, it's been documented in this IBM Think story. And in fact, somebody's done a film on it. So you can get those objective materials. They had some sort of examination or qualification process, and about 25-30 kids were given this opportunity. A very fine, then very young person, Henry Platt, was a psychologist who had bumped into Tom Watson at the World's Fair and struck up a conversation, and the idea for this was hatched right there. So by late 40, IBM sponsored a laboratory for high school kids. He was the administrator for it, and it was just that. And they, by design, would have had mentors to guide people's research, but they never found anybody who knew anything about what I was doing. And so I ended up doing histochemistry, cytochemistry, and I was going to study the two things I mentioned before, the how the change in staining properties of cellular materials under different fixation regimes might be clues to their chemical composition, Specific case, what was the chemistry of the nucleolus? Well, I was in really deep water on that. I mean, I could do experiments in which I fixed preparations, things like onion root tip or whatever, different pHs and different solvents and so forth. In retrospect, none of the reagents I knew about would have told me enough to reveal much about what was there except lipid solubility and so on. But Brache did do the right experiment with enzymatic extractions, and I didn't know enough to extend the range of reagents, but there's still a lot of aspects of staining we don't understand. And I was just trying to get some sort of rational framework for why one dye works better than another one. Is it the PK, other binding properties, and so forth? I wasn't way over my head, but I had the literature. There had been a little work on staining of model substances under those conditions. I remember one paper that stuck with me a long time by Eister. This had to do with specific uptake of methylene blue by charcoal, and what it boils down to is whether there are sites that are specific for things like sulfonamides. And he thought he had evidence that you could use methylene blue as a blanket reagent for adsorption, and you could displace some of those sites with more specific ligands. And I tried to repeat the experiments that didn't succeed in corroborating what he described, but it's been something I've been puzzling about to this day, whether that isn't something worth looking into, that you could think of charcoal as just a random ensemble of sites, and you could use competitive displacement on it for much more specific sorts of separations doing today. Well, that would have been ideologically connected with the issues of specificity and staining. So that's what I was up to. I think during that time I learned something about colchicine, and I'm pretty sure I started that project there and then continued that when I entered into college. And I was very interested in what the physiology of mitosis would be. And here was a very specific reagent that seemed to do nothing else but disrupt mitosis. And just wanted to see if I could understand more about its physiology. Well, we didn't know zilch about what the receptor for colchicine was. It wasn't until sometime later that we knew about tubulin and so forth, which it specifically absorbed. It was a good idea. Again, how to make it applicable with the available technologies, another story. But I started looking at other metabolic poisons and what they could do to mitosis. Tried to see if by using cyanide and urethane and fluoride and the range of metabolic inhibitors as was known up to that time, where you could get some clue as to how this particular inhibitor was working, or what was the dependence of mitosis on energy sources and things of that sort. And, there were a few very reputable scientists soon found out doing not too distant kinds of things. And, it's never ended up being all that productive, but that's because you're dealing with very loosely coupled issues. If you interrupt energy sources, obviously contractile mechanisms, and mitosis is just one of thousands of things that are going to be hit. But it was a way to learn more about, again, it's an interaction of known metabolic inhibitors with some unknown in a biological process that I was trying to get into.
You mentioned Brache's paper. So he was doing the work essentially the same time you were.
Yes.
But unknown because of the war.
Yeah, that's right. I had some correspondence a little about that just 4 or 5 years ago. He died in I'm a little puzzled he was able to continue to flourish and publish. You know, the work didn't get out. He was obviously not a member of the resistance. I don't know what else was going on in Belgium, but there was a lot of, to me, startling sort of life as normal aspect about that during that occupation. His name has been Lederberg. He wasn't able to do that.
Wow. I think we've already talked about you wanted to go to Cornell, or you at least you also applied to Cornell. CCNY was there really for you, and then
it was last resort.
Got the scholarship. You got a scholarship at Columbia.
Yeah, covered tuition or most of tuition.
And you were still living at home and commuting from Washington Heights. Started at Columbia in
September of 41.
Had you spent any time on the Columbia campus before you arrived there as a student?
I might have seen it more or less from the outside. I knew it by reputation, but as I've mentioned in the other transcript, I was not aware that E.B. Wilson was no longer there. but I'd known about Thomas Hunt Morgan and Wilson, believed, not totally inaccurately, that it was a great center of biological research. But nobody advised me. Nobody really knew zilch about scientific capabilities. And schools had reputations in those days that had much more to do with their football teams than anything else.
Sometimes they still do.
Well, at least there are other avenues of inquiry. But anyhow, I don't know. What I did not know was the feasibility of going to a good state university. Traveling out of state, I would have had to work in order to get my board and room. And it was an option nobody mentioned to me. Maybe even out-of-state tuition, even in those days, would have been enough to have hindered it. But the main point is the vacuum of advice on those points. Not every kid was going to college in those days, although I suppose most Stuyvesant graduates were expected to. But I don't recall ever hearing anything sensible from any advisor there. But when I compare that to what kids go through today,
right,
it's astonishing.
So Stuyvesant sort of left you on your own?
It seems so. Now they have a complete blank on that. They must have been some help to me in contacting Columbia to apply for scholarship. And so on. I think they may just have decided that the financial circumstances were such it was sort of hopeless. I was going to go to City College, and if something else came along, well, okay. But what I resent is that nobody pointed out, but to teach at a great state university not too many years after that, nobody ever mentioned that possibility. But I may not have been able to make it either. But well, Columbia worked out just fine. I'm very lucky to have gone there. So.
It's surprising in a way because a school like Stuyvesant with the reputation it had, as you said, most of the students were expected to be going on to college, that they weren't more vigorous in the student advising.
Well, I do find that difficult to understand. I may be blocking out in some history, but it's not the kind of thing I would expect to have done. But this, kids are nurtured more carefully today, generally. I mean, when we talk about these age issues and so on, it was less startling then than it would be now. I mean, kids were expected to be on their own a lot more than today.
You went to
earlier, the sooner, and so on. Yeah.
You went to the admissions office, and you made the took care of all of that.
Well, it would have been by mail. I don't remember doing it personally.
Okay.
I think it was all. I just don't recall. Could have had something to do.
So when you started in September of 41, were you getting any advice then from Columbia faculty, or were you just thrown in as a standard?
No, that as soon as I was there, it was a very different milieu, and I don't remember exactly whom I met first there, but you know, within a week or two, I had met Barbara McClintock and talked to her about my paper on the nucleolus, and she, you know, helped me understand it more deeply, and so on. And that this is one of many. I very quickly located. I was very aggressive about it, but ingratiated myself with all the talent that was there. I never lacked for sense.
This was the paper you wrote in high school.
Yeah.
Okay. But not, and I'm not familiar, I'm not clear. Since we haven't been able to locate your publication list, was that published in a? It was just a paper you wrote based on what you were doing.
Yeah. Well, I'm trying to recall a little more. Oh, I know. One of the first people I met was my ZO1 instructor, H. Burr Steinbach. It was one of the first courses I took, and I'd started working on the nucleolus, but I wrote this paper during my first semester there. Or at least another version of it, and it was during for the preparation of that paper that I went to consult with Clinton. So I would meet the professors in my courses, and I did have an advisor. It was I think was originally a physicist called Vinodroff, who I think was brother of a previous principal at Stuyvesant, and then Keller, the psychologist, whom I've kept in some contact with. So I started getting very good advice, as well as easy access to teachers and graduate assistants and things of that sort. So I more or less lived in that department from that time on. What a wonderful time.
You had already been so advanced in what you had been doing up to this point. Did they start you out in regular introductory courses, or could you start much further down the line?
Well, I discussed that, and I was able to place in quite a few of them. I did get some list. I think I have my curriculum summarized there. Yeah, these are my first courses. So, I started right off. It was just as well. I didn't know the comparative anatomy and morphology that was there. Then went straight on to the next level courses, embryology, morphogenesis, and so on. Now, this is the paper I just mentioned to you.
Okay.
And then by the next semester or during that year, I was already into the graduate courses. These the three-digit courses were all graduate courses.
Okay. In my file, I have copies of that.
Oh yeah.
Correspondence with Stadola.
Yeah. Well, he was just a wonderfully nurturing person, and I placed to an advanced level in his course, and then completed it over that summer. And you saw how encouraging he was. Mm-hmm. He died just about 6 months ago. Mm-hmm. Just recently got notice of it.
What about original research?
Well, I was playing around with colchicine during that first year, and the only new finding I made was that there was a susceptibility gradient down the axis of the tip, and that the most actively dividing cells right at the tip of the meristem were less susceptible than the ones behind it. and trying to make some sense out of that, but phenomenon's real. You could find critical concentrations where you get the interrupted mitoses up to a certain level, and then they'd be normal below it. Never was able to straighten out, but that was differential absorption, which you could call the pharmacokinetics of it, or the an intrinsic difference in the cells. Still don't know.